This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Victor Lund, investor, entrepreneur, and former chairman and CEO of the American Stores Company. In the late 1980s, American Stores was the largest drugstore retailer in the United States. They were also the third largest grocery retailer in the country. American Stores was so big, in fact, that it ultimately sold to Albertsons for $11.7 billion in 1998. Victor also served or serves on the boards of some of the nation's largest companies, including Delta Airlines, where he helped the company navigate out of its 2005 bankruptcy and back into profitability. You've likely heard of several of the other companies that Victor has served on the board of directors of, including Del Monte Foods, Mariner Healthcare, and a small startup called Bill Me Later that went on to sell to eBay for just under $1 billion. Vic, it's a pleasure and an honor to have you as a guest as the Bottom Line. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Doug.
So let's start with American Stores. That's a name that most of us here in Utah are very familiar with. That was run by the Skaggs family.
Correct, yeah.
Acquisition from the Skaggs company kind of built that conglomerate. And you built your career alongside Skaggs.
Yep.
Talk to us about how you first got introduced to the Skaggs family and what your first roles were at that company.
I met the Skaggs, and actually Sam Skaggs was the runner, the CEO and chairman, and had been for he got the business. His father died when Sam was in his 20s, and he took over the business, and it was a small company, and he grew it. And I became acquainted with him as an auditor when I first got out of college. Well, I guess roundabout time. I graduated from the U with a BA in accounting, and went to Phoenix to work for now defunct Arthur Anderson. And then Uncle Sam decided I should see a little bit of the Southeast. So I got drafted and spent some time in Vietnam and came back and got an MBA. And after I graduated with that, I went to work for then Ernst & Ernst, an accounting firm, and Skaggs was one of our clients. So I was on that account for a couple of years, and they offered me a job. Not really a job, but just to come to work for them. They were basically 50-year-old guys that had brought the company up, and they decided to bring some young talent in. And I looked at it and thought it was a great opportunity. So I went, and I actually didn't have a job description when I started out. So that's how I ended up there.
Didn't have a job description, although I suspect accounting and helping with the financial aspects of the business was a key part of it.
Yeah, my wife claims over the years I was the fireman. So whatever needed to be done, I kind of got thrown at that.
Right. That's a good description.
Yeah. So, you know,
I did not grow up here in Utah. I grew up in Ohio. My father was in the convenience grocery business himself. He worked at what the equivalent here in Utah would be a 7-Eleven.
Yep.
I know a little bit about the grocery business, and the only reason his business was able to survive in the early days in Ohio is the major grocery stores were prohibited from being open on Sundays.
Yep.
And they had to close by law at a certain time. Thus, convenience stores had a niche that they could serve. What was the grocery business like in Utah back then?
Well, if you look back in the – we actually weren't in the grocery business. When I started with Skaggs, we were drugstores only. And the drugstores that you saw then were bigger than the ones today. Probably twice as big, and they were pre-Kmart and stuff. So if it was Halloween, you'd go get your mask there, or, you know, Valentine's, a lot of Christmas toys, all that kind of stuff. And as Kmart and Target and others got big and came in, that was that kind of product went away, and now you have the typical Walgreens, if you will. You go here today, it's about 8,000 or 9,000 square feet, and basically driven around healthcare. But back then, we were the first mass marketers. And so when I joined the company, we were, I think we were under $1 billion in sales, like 800 million, and I can't remember the number of drugstores we had. But Sam and Joe Albertson had pioneered in Texas what was called a combination store. And what they did was take the old grocery store, which was probably about 20,000 square feet or 25, and the old drugstore, and they pushed them together in one store, and they were wildly successful. And that grew in Texas, and it got that partnership was so successful that it got to where one or the other had to buy the other one out, And Sam and Joe were both strong-willed guys, and neither wanted to work for the other. So we just divided it up. And there were stores in Florida and Texas by this time. But as a result of that, we needed drug expertise. And so Sam found then American Stores. So we were Skaggs companies, found American Stores, which operated grocery stores on the West Coast, Alpha Beta. On the East Coast under the name of Acme around Philly. And then they had a small drug chain. And we actually acquired them. They had $6 billion in sales, and we were under a billion, but we made more money than they did.
So, because you were in the drugstore
business. Well, and better run. They were, you know, they had along. Sam was really a great operator. So we acquired them. And at that time, Linda and I moved our family to Pennsylvania, actually Delaware, and became part of a holding company. And we were supposed to be there 2 years, and we were there about a year, and then we just took control of the company and brought it back to Salt Lake. And at that time, we changed our name to American Stores, which reflected that. And so grocery stores at the time were trying to figure out they were. So the idea there was to create multiple shopping trips through a grocery. People shop at a grocery store more often than they do a drugstore or anything else. So the idea was to marry the frequent shops to a grocery store with the general merchandise and get them to buy more stuff. And it worked. I mean, it was great. So we grew, and then we later acquired Jewel Company, which had Save-On Drug and Jewel Food Stores and Star Markets.
And Jewel was a hostile takeover,
yeah.
If I'm correct, right? They resisted being acquired. Were you involved in the decision that, gee, these guys don't want to be acquired, but let's go after them anyways? I think the audience would find it interesting to see. Was that a hard decision to make, and why do you think ultimately you decided to go that route?
Well, so at the time we acquired these things, I guess when we acquired Jewel, I was, kind of new in a more strategic role, really starting to become part of top management. And I think Sam had decided that he wanted to expand geographically. And so we decided to go after them. And the whole hostile takeover thing, visited with them. They weren't interested. They had a bunch of people running them, living well in a holding company again. And so we did what was called, they called them then a bear hug. And that meant you sent them a letter that said, we are interested in acquiring you. And by the way, if you don't like this, we're going to go public. And so we went through that process and ultimately prevailed. And basically,
They're run by a board of directors, yeah. And we're going to talk about board involvement. You have a lot of experience in your career on that. But ultimately, they have to look after the shareholders.
That's exactly
if it's a
right.
good offer, they don't have a choice.
Yep. And that'd be an interesting subject to get into a little later. I happen to have a very strong view about that.
We have a lot of these that we're going to talk about. Actually, let's go ahead and talk about the acquisition and the responsibility of the board. Let's go ahead and do that now because it just blends right into what we're talking about. So this is the hostile acquisition of Jewels. You guys made an offer privately. Sounds like it was turned down. And you said, you know what, we'll take this public and we'll fight it there because you guys have a responsibility to do that. At that point, you were the firm hoping to acquire.
Correct.
You've also been on boards, I'm sure, where you've been on the reverse side. So what is your take on that situation?
Well, I think in that case, this was early days of M&A, they call it, mergers and acquisition. And a lot of people were doing that. And there were entrenched managements who didn't want to do the right thing for the shareholders. And so we made that offer, and they resisted right to the very end. I mean, we kept waiting for, and there are a lot of things you could do to push back. They could have bought a lot of their own shares or whatever. But we kept waiting for, we thought they were, because these were really smart guys, and we kept thinking, well, at the end of the day, they've got some master strategy they're going to pull off. And when it got right down to the wire for people to submit their shares for us to buy or not, they just folded. Never did a thing. And it was really kind of stunning. And we did, a little bit of dancing around and bought them and pulled them in. And it was, and so it worked well. But it boiled down to us offering enough money. And it's, so boards have a fiduciary obligation. And that means we have an obligation when you're on a board to take care of the shareholders. And the shareholders are the people that own the shares. And so you really have three constituencies in a board. You've got shareholders, you got management, and you got the people that work for the company. And as a board, you have a right to think about all that stuff. You are not obligated as a board member to take the first price that comes along down the road. Somebody can come in and offer a price that is higher than you're selling for today, but you don't have to do that. If management has a plan in place that you think as a board member will deliver higher value over a period of time, whatever period of time you think is relevant, you're allowed to say to the people that came in, go away. We're not going to do that. We find ourselves in a position where we think the plan management has is better. But as a board, you have to go through the process of making that determination. And so that's a really important function of a board.
And you have to CYA. You got to do a little bit of protecting yourself legally. And in today's world, how does the board do that? I would think you have a third party of smart people that are investment bankers give you an evaluation so you have something to back it up. Or can you just as a board say, we believe in management and their current plan, and with no third party endorsement, can you feel comfortable from a legal standpoint on that?
I think it depends on where you are, right? If it is... close to where you're trading today, and the other people don't have what you think is the capabilities of completing a transaction and all that, I think without bringing advisors in, you can do that. And advisors are interesting, and when it gets really complicated, you have to have those, and it's really a lot of it legal protection to say we relied on this. But I think at the end of the day, the best protection or the best asset that a board can have is to be well informed about the company's strategy. So you can't sit on a board and not really understand what makes a business work. And even if somebody comes with a third-party appraisal of it, in essence, is what it is. If you don't understand the business, how do you make sense out of it?
Yeah. So board positions are very different today than maybe they were 30 years ago. And you've been serving on boards for decades. Yep. So we're going to circle back to that. But I wanted to talk about that because it was relevant with the hostile takeover of Juul. If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Victor Lund, former CEO of the American Stores Company, as well as former board member of Delta Airlines, Borders Bookstores, and Del Monte Foods. So let's transition, because you've got such an interesting journey. You've been working a long time and had a lot of neat experiences. Part of the experience at American Stores, in 1988, you guys decided to go after the Lucky Stores chain in California. The Federal Trade Commission said, hey, we're nervous that this is going to reduce competition in the grocery and drug business. They resisted it. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court. That had to be really fascinating to see that experience.
It was one of the most fascinating things that I've done in my career. So we had good legal advisors who told us that if we were approved by the Federal Trade Commission, and the Federal Trade Commission is a group in Washington, federal government, who looks at competitive impacts of acquisitions. And if they approve the transaction, we were told by our legal advisors, and you close and no one else is sued, you're home free. Well, it turns out it wasn't quite right, because the California AG sued us after the fact. We thought we were going to win. We didn't at a court level in California. We went all the way to the Supreme Court, as you say, and we lost there. And we had to go through a process. We were still able to buy Lucky, but we ended up having to sell a lot more stores than we had anticipated doing. It still turned out to be a great acquisition. But the thing that I learned about that, which has nothing to do with retail or anything, was that the judicial system isn't what a lot of people think it is. I thought the law was clear, you complied with the law, you go do it, and really smart people will take a very narrow view. I realized when we got to the Supreme Court, we were there on competitive things. Had we complied with the Federal Trade Commission and all that? And we had. If you looked at the laws in that narrow sense, we should have won hands down. Well, it turned out there were two justices, one of them being Clarence Thomas. They viewed the issue from a state's rights issue. And so they voted against us and turned the tide the other way. Had nothing to do with the issue we were in front of them. They just felt like the federal government shouldn't be able to tell a state what to do. And so it was none of their business. And our lawyers had never mentioned that to us. So I learned to have an appreciation for the law. If you're involved in it, you really have to have a broad view about what goes on. But it was fascinating to watch. We actually, Linda and I, went and sat in the Supreme Court and watched him argue, and it was...
Watch him argue your case,
yeah,
your
it was fascinating.
Case, yeah.
And we had actually our lawyer in the federal Supreme Court was Rex Lee, Mike Lee's father. And so it was, he did a great job. It was just somebody else had another agenda when we got there, right?
And for people listening, when you visit Washington, D.C., you can visit the Supreme Court in session. You'll be there for 10 minutes. They won't let you stay long. I remember as a 10 or 12-year-old going and just being thrilled by that experience. They have a balcony. They usher people in and out every 10 minutes or so, but it's definitely worth seeing.
It's almost a religious experience. I mean, they are very, very – I mean, there's a lot of pomp and ceremony, but it does have an aura of it. Like, it's – I mean, it's really got a sense about it that's
it does.
Hard
you
to
know
explain.
What, as an adult, what's fascinating to me is here's people that are at the top of their game, top legal minds in the country, and most decisions are split, you know, so – you have these brilliant minds. Very few decisions are unanimous. And so how can these brilliant minds split almost 50-50 on most cases?
Married people understand that. You know?
Ah, good point. Good point. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more with Victor Lund, investor, entrepreneur, and former CEO of American Stores Company. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Victor Lund, former CEO of the American Stores Company, as well as former board member of Delta Airlines, Borders Bookstore, Del Monte Foods, and others. So let's go back, keep talking about the journey at American Stores. So there was this period of consolidation where you were the acquirer.
Yep.
And then sometime in the early 90s, you started divesting some of these assets. What caused the change from growth to saying, let's start to spin off some assets?
Well, I think you look at – so you have to have competitive advantage in anything you do as a business, right? And so we realized through our journey and through the acquisitions that one of the key strategic strengths that we were developing – so we focused on California, we focused on Illinois, and we focused on Pennsylvania. Big cities, we were the number one retailer. It was very hard to get real estate. We had the dominant share, and we could rule, if you will, rule the roost in those areas. So we looked at what made us strong and competitive, how could we best push back competition, and we concentrated our assets in those areas, and then we spent a lot of money in those areas. Like, we were not in downtown San Francisco, for instance. And so we decided to build stores downtown, and we went about getting it. It took a long time and a lot of money, but they all turned out to be very good. Same thing downtown Chicago, downtown Philly, downtown not downtown LA, but the expensive suburbs of LA.
So it's a little bit of an aside. We're going to get to the divesting, but you just mentioned something about opening stores in San Francisco. I used to live in the Bay Area. I'd go downtown San Francisco, and it's hard for the Targets and the Walmarts to open stores, but eventually they figure it out, and they do have some stores. My sense was always those have to be loss leader stores, that the chains feel they should have a presence there. The real estate is so expensive. The labor is so expensive. The prices are about the same. Unless the volume makes up for it, were those prime real estate locations profitable in their own right?
Very.
Really? Because of the volume?
Well, yeah. I mean, you get a lot of volume. There's no competition or very limited competition. And the people, you know, they were great. And I think one of the things in the old days in retail, everybody looked, you know, the theory in retail when I first got into it was be the first person to a new subdivision with your store, right? And then people would come to you, they build new subdivisions and all that kind of stuff. Well, over time, as everybody had done that, we were bumping into each other. So the idea was, what's the reverse of that? And that is to go where the people are. And it's harder to do. It's more expensive. A lot of politics involved in getting them done. But those stores turned out to be very, very well. I don't believe you run a business for show or anything. Every investment you make's got to make money. And if it doesn't, you shouldn't be doing it. If ego is a part of your business process, you're gonna have trouble. It doesn't work.
Interesting. Well, I'm glad to hear that. So let's go back to the strategy of divestment and why you decided to divest some stores.
So we had a lot of stores like in Montana and, you know, around. They were smaller stores. Buttery, we owned them, and we owned Star Markets in Boston, which was a great town, but we were not the big gorilla in town. And so we looked at those and figured out we didn't want to be there, and people were willing to pay us great prices for those assets. And so we were able to sell them at a great price and redeploy those assets back where our margins were higher. And we could leverage our volume against an infrastructure that was in place. And so we just went about doing that. We undertook a strategy. We called it the Delta Project. And we had, at the time I became CEO, we had each one of our divisions was a separate company, if you will, and we were a true holding company. And we did finance and stuff like that, but we didn't really run the stores. And we undertook here to build a central operating company. And we did that to leverage a cost structure and leverage our talent and all that kind of stuff. So we brought that together, and American Stores became an operating company here in Salt Lake. And so we leveraged that. And as a part of that, we wanted to leverage costs because Walmart was starting to come in. So we had to be able to drive our cost structure down as a percent of sales. And that was our theory to do that. And that's what that was all about, was getting down to where we had a base where we could be competitive. And it worked. We were.
Yeah. And part of that strategy was also centralizing your management team.
Correct.
In the early 90s, you only had like 100 employees here in Salt Lake City. By the end of the 1990s, it was over 1,000 employees.
Yep.
Talk to us about the pros and cons. We hear all the time about companies consolidating their management team and then decentralizing. Having run a company that lived in both formats, Which one do you think is best, and when is it a match and when is it not a match?
Well, I don't think you do one or the other. We did. So, for instance, we centralized buying. We centralized administration. We didn't centralize marketing. We had guys that, and for me, guys are men and women. We had women presidents of some of our divisions and stuff. So we kept our marketing decisions, our product selection decisions, all of that were local, so we could take care of our local people. But the stuff that was just administrative, if you will, or that made sense to leverage, like buying all of our product, you get a better deal if you buy 2 billion of it than you do if you buy 1 billion. So we consolidated all of that and drove our costs down, but the marketing and taking care of the customer focus was left out. And so we were a hydra of both, and I'm a proponent of that. I think businesses aren't run by back ends, they're run by front ends. And if you are not focused on the customer, you're not there. I mean, I get a kick out of tech, for instance, now. You know, I've around quite a bit of tech, and you see young tech guys come up and they've got this great thing they want to do. And why do you want to do it? Well, because, you know, I was sitting and I can do it, but how big is your market? I mean, who cares that you can do that? And I think a lot of young tech guys make the mistake of doing something because it can be done, but there's no market for it. And you got to make sure when you start a process that somebody else is going to want it, or you think you can make them want it. And so you got to be customer focused. You got to look out to have a successful business.
Do you think it's harder to be customer focused when you have a big corporate headquarters where there are just layers and layers of folks whose job is to support people within the organization as opposed to the ultimate customer?
No, I'm a firm believer in people, right? I mean, you have to have a lot of people around who are smart. I spent my whole life hiring people smarter than I am. And it's not too hard to find people that are smarter than I am. But I looked at
now
a couple of things.
I've got to share. I don't know how I know this. I think it was on your LinkedIn profile. Back when you took your CPA test in the entire state of Utah, you were number one, which is, you know, incredibly. How many thousands of people take that test? So incredibly talented, which leads me into another area, which there are people that are super intelligent but have difficulty navigating the corporate landscape, if you will. Let's talk a little bit about how you mentioned earlier when I became CEO of American Stores. There's a whole lot behind that. You know, I'm sure that there were other people that were really hoping and working hard to become the CEO as well. What was that experience like? What do you think in your background led you to be the obvious choice to be the CEO? And is there some learnings for other people that maybe would like to follow a similar path?
Well, so people, when I say this, I mean, I get asked this not all the time, but I've been asked it multiple times. And I didn't start out to be a CEO. I quite honestly, when I started in the business world, I don't think I knew what a CEO was. I didn't even. So, I mean, there's a lot of old sayings, and I find old sayings live a long time there. But, you know, if you do the right things happen. And all I ever tried to do in my career was to do the right thing for the business and try and understand what that was and not get caught in politics and all that kind of stuff. So I never did. I mean, it worked out after, you know, obviously down the road at some point. I thought, well, I'd love to do that. But I found surrounding yourself with good people, making them part of your team, bringing them along with you, makes your next level of whatever it is you're going to do business easier. If you are afraid to share and develop your team around you, how can you possibly be promoted? Because you create yourself, you have to be where you are, and that can be whatever level you find yourself frozen in. So I think to become CEO, you have to be able to build a team around yourself. I think the other key attribute for being a CEO or any business, running your own business and doing well, it's what I call the so what. So I had MBAs that would come work for me as CEO, and I'd bring them in for 3 months, and it was young people we were hiring. I wanted to see what kind of talent we had, so I'd give them a project. And every one of them could come back with a spreadsheet, and they could tell me all this data and what they had done and bring it in. But the question for the ones that ended up getting ahead, I'd say, oh, so that's the so, but so what? What are you going to do with that? What does that mean? And it's remarkable how few people can answer so what. And so I think that is probably the number one attribute that makes a difference. But I do, to be a successful CEO, you got to have a lot of really smart, good people around you, and you got to let them run. You got to let them do their own thing. If you micromanage them, you're limited the capabilities of your organization because we can only do so much. But I found people that were smart and that I trusted and I knew were in for the right reasons. They wanted the business to succeed rather than themselves. And we built a team at American that did that. And that's the secret, I think.
Yeah, that's great advice. And it sounds like in your situation, really, you know, looking out for the best interests of the company, doing the right things. I categorize that as one of the good guys, and it's nice to see one of the good guys win and ultimately make it to that position, because there are politics in big corporations. And I think, you know, a large part of our audience enjoys this show. We talk to entrepreneurs that have gone out and started companies. The reality, most of us work within an organization, so we're more of, I think the term is an intrapreneur, within an organization. So this type of advice is really important. What about, you know, another area that is difficult for people within an organization is when somebody on their team's not a match. You talked about believing in people and hiring the right people. You know, even the best manager, if he or she is batting 750, they're doing very, very well. What advice do you have for folks that need to make that difficult decision and somebody's not a match?
Well, you know, the thing I found, I had a lot of those tough calls with people over my career. And the thing that I came to realize over time is the person that's not a match knows it as well as you do. And so being honest with them about why they aren't a match. And first of all, I think it starts within an organization is you've got to make sure they know ahead of time. They've got to have had a chance to correct and do better and succeed. But if you've been through that process and being honest with them about what they need to be and they just aren't going to make it, then you have to part ways. But if you've been through that process, most people I found at the end of the day, it's a shock sometimes. But most of the time, it's not. And when all said and done, they're happy to be out of a very stressful situation because it's stressful for everybody. And, you know, Jack Welch from GE had he said the hardest person to fire was the good-hearted, hardworking person who just wasn't performing. He said they're the hardest people to deal with because everybody loves them and they work hard and they have all the right ethics. But, you know, success at the end of the day is about results. And I used to tell our folks who are having a hard time with it, look, you're going to swim across this river, and every person you drag along who isn't pulling their weight is a bucket with a chain, and you're going to drag them. If you get enough of those trying to swim across and you're dragging 15 buckets with it, you're going down. And it's not just you, it's your entire organization that you're taking down. You owe it to this organization to have it succeed. And to do that means you're here to make the tough calls.
Yeah, you have at a company like American Stores, you have thousands of employees, and you have to look at after their families as well.
Yeah, and you know, you might have a tough decision for one, but your objective is to try and save as many jobs, and not only just save those jobs, but build an organization that succeeds and thrives and provides a future. And that's what management's about. I mean, it's what leadership's about. I've heard a lot of great sayings, and I can never remember who, but one I loved was managers manage and leaders lead. And the difference between that is managers are given format in which they work, and they're told what to do, and they know what to do, and they do it very, very well. And organizations need managers. I mean, they're very, very key. Leaders, on the other hand, are probably more risk-oriented, try and figure out what moves things forward, and they're not afraid to be out in front a little by themselves. you know, and so it's, you need both kinds, but they're different.
You need both kinds, and I think sharing with the audience and your views on this is as well. You know, my experience is both of those skills can be learned, you know, and I think our educational system does a great job of teaching people how to be managers, how to be a leader. Some folks are fortunate to get that experience through sports. Other folks learn that on the job. And there's these inflection points in your career. And I have found it's helpful for me with somebody on my team to share with somebody, hey, I see you at an inflection point. It's great. You've done really well at this, which opens up this avenue. It's not easy. You are at this inflection point. You need to learn new skills because there is a difference, as you point out, between being a leader and being a manager, between being somebody that shares information and results and being somebody that has to make results happen. Your so what question yeah. earlier. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I think the number one thing to assume a leadership role is self-confidence. You know, and I don't mean ego. There's a difference, but you have to believe in yourself. And I'll still never forget, and it's going to seem odd, that first event occurred to me. So when I got out, I was working for Ernst & Ernst, just out of school. And I was, it'd been about a year. And, you know, I graduated from the University of Utah twice, and I'm at this conference in L.A. with all these guys who are about a year or two out, same as I, and they were from Harvard and Stanford and UCLA and USC. And I thought, what am I doing here? You know, I mean, these guys are all from these big schools, and I'm a country boy. I grew up out in Bountiful. You know, I really didn't know much. And we were there for a week, and I didn't realize at the time. I guess we were the young guys they thought had some potential. But in that week period, I realized that I could compete with them. And for me, I think that was probably the point in time when I thought, you know, I'm as good as the guys that go to Harvard. I'm as good as the guys that go to USC. I may not have had the benefit of that. I may not have been raised in a family where we knew all that. But I have horse sense, and I know what. And I have, and I'm not afraid of these guys anymore. And I think for me, that was the point at which I actually realized I had that. And then
that was your inflection point.
That was my inflection point. And then over time, I think you learn how to do stuff and you have some success and you find out people pay attention to what you're saying. But that happens because you, not because you want them to pay attention to you, but because you've analyzed something, a situation, and you've made good recommendations and you've brought along a team. And then people go, okay, yeah, I believe this person has some capabilities that we ought to explore.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Victor Lund, former CEO of the American Stores Company, as well as former board member of Delta Airlines, Borders Bookstores, and Del Monte Foods. So I want to wrap up the American Stores. We're just at the halfway point in this discussion because you've had such a rich career. So American Stores, I mentioned 1,000-plus employees here in Salt Lake City in the late 1990s. Beautiful corporate headquarters. I had moved to Salt Lake City shortly after you guys had your grand opening. I think I was there a week or two after. It was just blown away. I mean, I had lunch there. It was just such a fabulous location. Shortly thereafter, and I think weeks or months at most thereafter, you made the decision to sell American Stores to Albertsons. I mentioned it earlier, $11.7 billion. Talk to us about that decision. So Sam Skaggs was the founder, built it from a relatively small company to some big. You played a key role in making that a reality as well. And now you guys are selling your baby. That had to be difficult.
Well, it was. At that point, Sam had sold all his shares. He wasn't a shareholder anymore. We went through a process there with that. And so we were down. But here again, being honest about where you are, we continually evaluated our markets and where we were and what was going on. And we talked a bit about a board and management's responsibility to shareholders. And part of that is to you have to develop a high return. And PEs had gotten price earnings multiples. So for those who aren't business types, companies earn so much a share and the market values them at some multiple or some times that number is how you get a valuation.
You make a dollar in a company.
PE's 12, it's worth 12 bucks.
12 bucks, exactly.
Yeah, and our PEs had gotten high and given that Walmart was coming in and taking, they were pushing hard in the grocery business and all of that, we made a determination that PEs were at really historic highs, and then Albertsons came in and topped that even. So we looked at it and tried to figure out what was the best thing for our shareholders, and we decided that that was the right place to be. And, you know, it turned out we were. That was right. PEs have never been that high since. And, I mean, I remember Kroger's share price was $23 and something like that. And they really, they're now above that now, but it's taken 20 years. Our shareholders had the benefit of that. So it was just simply that was our job and our obligation. It's never easy. A lot of good people and all of that. But, you know, it's been fun. I keep in touch with a lot of the folks, and our people have all gone off and done just fabulous things. One ran the U.S. for Walmart. Another guy's now currently running Publix. Another one ran Porter's Bookstores. I mean, it could go on and on. These folks have
another
all...
one helps out with entrepreneurship at the University of Utah.
Yeah, Brad Varick. Troy's up there, and Brad Varick, who runs the MBA program. I mean, we had good people, and they've all done great. And, you know, we...
Is that one of the things you're most proud of, is just seeing the alumni and the impact that they've had on Utah?
Utah and wherever they're just, but you know, they were solid, solid, good people. Teresa Beck, who was our president at the time, has, you know, been very, very instrumental on a lot of boards.
I have to tell you, in these business shows, I am surprised at how often people mentioned American Stores, and they had some involvement early in their career. It's 10 seconds of the interview, but they mentioned it. Like, we had Troy D'Ambrosia over at the business school on the show, and he mentioned, you know, his role at American Stores. So, not only did you build a great company, but it has a ripple effect, and I think Utah's been very fortunate for years and really decades because of it.
Yeah, it's, I mean, they were great people. You know, it's really we were the beneficiary of them, I guess I would say.
that's wonderful. You know, you mentioned Walmart and it being a factor as you looked at the future. We mentioned the value that a local corporation can have, bringing in talent, grooming talent, and then that talent helping out in the local economy. I'm going to put you on the spot here. What do you think? Is Walmart good for the country? They're not doing that stuff.
Well, so Walmart is now where we were 20 years ago, right? They're having, in retail, one of the measures you measure to see how good a business is doing is same store sales. And that is, how much revenue did you do in your stores that have been open over a year versus last year? And that, what that is an indication, is that store growing from year to year versus are you just building a lot of new ones? And so Walmart has a whole different philosophy. Theirs is low cost, everything in Bentonville. They have been extremely hard on smaller businesses, you know, that's littered with people that got Walmart business, and they grew their business, and then Walmart found somebody else that would do it for 10 cents less. And those people went broke. So I think Walmart's a good retailer. I don't like to throw stones and all of that, but I think it's a different model than local retailers have and local businesses. I think businesses should give back to a community and what they take away. But I think they've been wildly successful, right? And it's hard to argue with that.
An American success story.
Yeah,
when
very
you look at Sam Walton and his family, and worked hard and started small and pieced together something. And sometimes an organization can be a victim of their own success.
Almost always they are.
I put you on the spot. I'll share my thoughts. You know, frankly, I feel I do shop at Walmart. I feel guilty when I go. I feel much better when I shop at Costco. I know those employees are getting paid a livable wage. When I talk to the employees, they like their job. They're grateful for the job. And I'd like to see more of a middle ground where it's not all about driving costs as low as possible. It's also about, as you point out, giving back to the community, giving back to their team. I think that's an important component.
Well, and you know, part of that, though, goes back to all of us, right? Because for local business to succeed and do that, the consumers have to be willing to pay the increased price for that.
That's why I feel guilty going to Walmart.
And so, I mean, I think it's great to throw that out there and talk about that. And I agree with you 100%. I don't disagree. But we can't have, we as consumers can't have it both ways. You can't lament the fact that people don't pay their people fairly and that they don't provide health insurance and then go to the lowest cost place you can buy it, because those two things are diametrically opposed. And, you know, you see people in Europe do support their local businesses and small businesses and see that they have that. We don't do a very good job of that in the U.S. And so I agree with you 100%, but I think that that's going to require some bit of a revolution from consumers for it to work.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Victor Lund, former CEO of the American Stores Company, as well as former board member of Delta Airlines, Border Bookstores, and Del Monte Foods. So let's transition to some of the boards. You've been on boards for almost 30 years now. You joined, and I think Delta might be the most interesting one for us to start the conversation with, just because they were going through such a difficult time when you had joined them. Months before you joined the board, and you joined in February 2006, I believe.
It could be. I don't know.
Right around there. Several months after they went bankrupt. I think it was August of 2005 they went through bankruptcy. And so I'm curious, take us behind the scenes. What was that like? Obviously, it's a high-stress, high-stakes game. This is an airline that had been an icon in the U.S., did become an icon again, is thriving now. How did you get through that difficult period?
Well, the board that came on, there were a group of us that came at the same time. And what happened is they were getting ready to come out of bankruptcy. So bankruptcies a lot of times are packaged, which there was. They were going to go in, they do a few things, take care of some legal stuff. Bankruptcy allows businesses in trouble to do a lot of things they couldn't do otherwise.
Including renegotiating labor contracts.
Labor contracts. You can do away with all kinds of – you can do away with leases that you don't want anymore. So it provides an opportunity to get the business stable. So all of that was packaged. A group of us came on. We joined the board then. Started the process of going down, and our first role was to find a CEO. So we started, there were two individuals that were in the running, both of them younger guys that currently work there, and Ed Bastian, who's the now current CEO, is one of those, but he was a younger guy, and some other ones, and we went through, and one of the board members that joined with us was Richard Anderson, who ended up being the CEO, but he was a board guy. So in the search of this, we start, and got to watch Richard, and he was amazing. I'll never forget, we went, first board meeting we had, we were in Atlanta, and he and I were, they sent us out to see the mechanics. You know, the board wandered around trying to learn a little. And he had instant rapport with these guys. It was amazing to watch him. I mean, he was really good. And he was an individual that made some promises to the board, which were great, and he did it into the organization. But his total focus was on the consumer. He knew Delta was a great brand, but he looked at, you know, what do we have to do to make people want to fly Delta Airlines? And he had been had worked at Northwest before. And so he started down that process. He also did a great job of bringing the people together, understanding that it was important. The people that were in the airplanes or worked on them or flew them or all of that were an integral part of the success of Delta. And he involved all of those in the process. And he had a plan to do that. It wasn't, I mean, he came with a plan when he was there and he did it. And I mean, I think the most amazing thing he did, and because airlines can be really complicated, and I think
airlines are incredibly complex,
is that before, when we bought Northwest, before we closed the transaction, one of the stipulations was that the two pilot unions agree on a single contract and their bumping rights and everything. So,
which is a big deal for pilots, because the way they get their schedule is based on seniority. And anytime there's a merger, that's one of the biggest fighting that takes place, is how are they going to merge those two seniority lists?
And so you look at airlines today, nobody else has done that. So if you look at American Airlines, I think they still got pilots that are American, pilots that were U.S. Air, and pilots that were America West. And they're still not in a common agreement. And so it created a lot of opportunity. So I think here again, leadership was what made that happen. A board was there to support a very good leader. We had the confidence in him and the willingness to do that. But this man, he and he brought a great management team together, and they led that. And, you know, management has to lead a turnaround, but they did. But I really give him a lot of credit. He was an amazing CEO. He just stepped down, but really a smart, smart guy, and understood and kept it focused on the customer and the people.
It is amazing when you think about it, how many tens of thousands of employees are involved in an organization like Delta Airlines. Yep. I don't know. Just how complex the operations are, how many different locations that are serviced, and how the efforts of a couple strong leaders can impact the success of something that large. It's really quite staggering, and it's part of the attractiveness, I think, of leadership is you can have that kind of influence.
When the right people too. I mean, you know, look at Ed. He was hoping to be CEO when Richard made, but he stayed around, learned, and now he's got his great team player, right? He didn't let ego get in the way of doing the right thing. And he did. He was very instrumental in a lot of the stuff. He had big pieces of the business, too, that he helped turn around. So I think it's good people that are the right people that have the right kind of heart is what makes success happen.
Yeah, you were talking about your inflection point a couple years ago as an individual, as a leader. You know, one of my inflection points was before I went to business school. Just seeing other people, I was in the Bay Area at the time, that had succeeded, that had been entrepreneurs. Or frankly, I thought they were cut from a different cloth than I was. And seeing folks that, you know what, they're real people just like I am. So and it's moments like that. Talk to us about, I think a lot of people look at board membership, and few of us will ever be on a board, right? But for those of us that do get that opportunity, how do you get your name in the hat for something like that? So somebody's been successful here in business in Salt Lake City. They think they'd like to be involved in other boards. How does that process start?
Well, you know,
is it by invitation only, or are there things you can do to make sure your name's at least thought of?
Well, in every board but one that I've served on, they came to me. So I, you know, and I, being a CEO, helped, and having served on
a
publicly held company helped. And so they've come to me. And interestingly enough, the only board that didn't happen with was Delta. And I was sitting in the house reading that they were looking at board members. And I looked at my wife and said, you know, I think I could be helpful on that board. They're heavily unionized, which we were, deal with a lot of people. I understand numbers with a finance background. And so I happened to know the headhunter, the recruiter, who was, and so I called her up and said, I want you to toss my hat in the ring. She said, I'll do it. Don't hold your breath, but I'm glad to do it. And she did, and it turned out great. But other than that, people have come to me, and it's, you know, I knew somebody on that board, and so they were looking for a certain skill set. I think to serve on a board, boards today try and have skill sets that they're looking for. Not, you want a group of individuals with different background and a common vision. That's what you hope to have out of a board. And so you try to find somebody who's got a finance background, somebody maybe a marketing background, somebody that's been in operations, and bring that group together. But boards, you know, boards' roles are one of oversight, not one of doing management, builds the strategy, executes the strategy, all of that. Boards do, you know, not two or three things that are all very important. One is that they review the strategy and make sure that they think management's done a good job. Secondly is that they ensure that there's a succession plan in place, that is, that management will replenish itself so they can execute the strategy. And then the third thing they do is they represent the shareholders, and that is try and make sure that management is focused on not themselves, but the good of the business. And if the good of the business is doing well, shareholders typically do well.
You've been on many boards, and we're going to talk about a couple more of them. Are there, of those three aspects, of those three responsibilities you just shared, is there one that's more the most difficult of the three?
Yeah, I think succession is the hardest. Because in today's environment, I mean, you work at it, you can do everything you can do, right? But when it comes time to be a CEO, it is something nobody can prepare you for. I mean, and so as a group of individuals, you're looking, you're trying to find the right person who can step into that role and do it. But, you know, it's a complex issue, right? You've got the people that have grown up in the business and they know the business well, and they come along and they're part of the strategy and all that kind of stuff. So they're your one list of candidates, and that's who you are always cheering for because you know when you're there. And then the other list is somebody that might bring a different edge or a view to it and the kind of leader they are. So it is very, very difficult to pick succession and make sure it works, because you can't just have a strategy that works and you do it forever, because that's how you die, right? You got to reinvent yourself all the time. And so part of picking the next level of leadership is, are these the people that are going to be able to come in and give us a new edge and see the world a new way and give us a way to stay on top? And so I think succession is clearly the hardest.
Is it, you know, I know A players hire A players, and the folks that you're considering for CEO, they're all A players. They're all highly competent. Is it hard to convince the CEO, look, we really do need two or three people deep, any one of which could do your job if you got hit by a bus?
Not a good one. He ought to want that. That's one of the things I look at in my life. If I'm on a board and I've got a CEO who doesn't want people smarter than him around, I don't think much of him. Because, I mean, it's stifling to an organization. What does that do? It limits what the organization could do, because if you don't have the very best people reporting to you, you can't delegate. So if you've got to be in control of everything all the time, one person is the gating point. But if you've got 20 people that can do stuff, you can do 20 or 40 or 60 times as much stuff. So anybody that is of that, I don't think great CEOs aren't afraid to have good people. They might be tough, and they might, you know, all of that, but they give their people, you got to give them, you know, the old thing, give them enough rope to hang themselves, and they'll either rope a cow or they'll hang themselves. And you want people that know how to bring the cow in, right? You want them to take that rope and go out and run and grow a business. And that's how they learn how to be a CEO and are a candidate to do that. If you don't do that, how are they ever going to have the capability? And you got to let them have a chance to fail.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a position that nobody's really ever fully prepared for. It's, you know, we're in the middle of the political campaign for president. We're not going to go there.
Good.
But yeah, the truth is, nobody's fully prepared to be president of the United States. I mean, it's just such a daunting task as a CEO until you've done it a couple times.
Well, I never had a promotion I felt like I was ready for when I got it, right? I mean, if it's truly a promotion, then you probably haven't done it before, right? And so I don't think people should be fearful that they don't know 100% what they're going to do. It gets back to you having faith in yourself, having built a skill set that you know how to go to, and having a group of people around that will help you, support you, and see that you get there.
So let's talk about a couple other of the boards. You know, as I looked at your board service, and I should share, your son and I have been friends for years and years, and I've worked with your family professionally over the years as well. So I've talked to your son, Jeremy. In fact, he's been a guest on the show here in the past as well, about some of your board membership. Always very, you know, impressed. But I got a chance to kind of, as I was doing research, find out more about these companies. And here's what I'm impressed with. You're in some really companies that I think are very relevant and very interesting in today's world, but you joined these boards years earlier, before it was clear that the space was really an interesting space. And one of those is Teradata,
yep,
which is big data.
Yeah.
Tell us a story about how you found out about, well, first tell us what Teradata does, and then share with us how you found out about them.
Well, Teradata is the largest database company in the world, and they do databases that aren't just databases. They are stacks and vaults, and so they built a database. Teradata is the one that built and came up with a database where it's a rational database, and what that means is you can access that database from multiple points. You don't have to have the information 47 times in business. You can have it once, and the 47 places can access this. And so they developed it, learned how to make it fast, totally reliable. And so that was their starting point. And they were actually, I became acquainted with Teradata when I joined NCR's board. And they NCR owned them.
Which stands for National Cash Register back in the day. So it shows how many iterations a company like NCR has gone
and
through.
And so NCR did, at the time, made when you check out in a grocery store, the scanners at the time were NCR. And that's how I got on NCR's board. And so then when we decided to break the company into two pieces, I got on Teradata. I wanted to go with Teradata.
About when was that?
Oh, geez, it's probably been 6 or 7 years. I'm terrible with time.
Yeah, I'd say about a decade. And, yeah, you know, big data is hot now. It was not hot. I mean, even the name, I mean, Teradata, when Teradata was named, a terabyte of data was a lot. Now that company should be called Zettabyte.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It was hard to even envision a terabyte of data back then.
Well, and so, yeah, they did that. And so it's fascinating to go through. You know, had a lot of they're in the middle of a transformation that's been, you know, announced publicly where they're morphing again. I mean, the world in tech just changes so fast. And so they're using the strengths. They got, I mean, truly, truly really, really smart people. I mean, then you talk to these people and they're just amazing. But so they're in the middle of going through that. So I got involved and found it fascinating, and I had to learn an awful lot. I'm not a techie by background, and I probably am not a techie today. But I know enough about technology to understand what makes it successful and what you have to do. And you know, I'm never afraid to ask a question. I say there's no stupid question, and I believe that you can't learn if you don't ask questions. Then you only know what you know. So
when people explained to you Teradata back before you joined the board, they were trying to convince you to come on board. Did you see that bright future? Was it really clear to you that was going to play out? And would you serve on a board if you're like, I don't know, I don't think that's actually a good strategy. I don't think that's a good space.
So the first one is, when we joined Teradata, I'll never forget Mike Kohler, who's the CEO today. I was sitting down talking to him when we were getting ready to spin it out. And they were doing great. And I said, well, Mike, what's restricting your growth? And he said, well, you know, they won't give me all the people I need. So I knew when we spun them out. And sure enough, Mike expanded the sales force and we grew, you know, just unbelievably well. So, I could see, you don't ever know, but you believe. And, you know, my gut check is, does it make sense? The so what question was. So I asked myself before I joined a board, what is your strategy? Why are you going to compete? Do I believe you're going to be able to compete? I want to understand who their competitors are. And look and see, do they have a chance for success? So I've joined some boards like Bill Me Later would be one where it looked like we should be successful, but you don't know. But they had the possibility of success. There was a market. They had a product that should work there. And so, I do that. I wouldn't join a board just to join a board. Life's too short, you know. And I managed to stay plenty busy doing things that are fun right now, and so I don't need to do that.
Well, let's talk about Bill Me Later, because I think that's a good example. You said, you know, when you joined, it wasn't clear what their path was going to be. That was a company, I believe, was started by Gary Marino.
Yep.
I read an interview with him. There were several times that the company was weeks away from insolvency before you joined the board.
Yeah.
But it was not at all clear. The company had to pivot several times. I think it's a really interesting story what Bill Me Later, how they pivoted and what they ultimately ended up doing. So, you know, PayPal is where you can use your credit card online. Yep. Tell us how Bill Pay is different and why they might have been of interest to eBay.
Well, so Bill Me Later started, you know, when the internet first started and shopping online and all that, people were nervous about their credit card, right? I'm going to give it out and I don't know who's there and they steal my card and it turns out going to happen anyway. But that was the paranoia stage about that. So Gary and his team came up with the philosophy that you would use Bill Me Later to pay. They would have your credit card, but you wouldn't give it to any of these people. You'd give them your Bill Me Later number, and then they would bill Bill Me Later, and Bill Me Later would pay them and then charge you. And so the key to their success was they had to be able to evaluate your credit risk, right, if they're going to put you in Bill Me Later. So they all came out of the banking business, and they created just off two things. They'd ask you your zip code and two other questions they had. And based on that, in 4 seconds, they could make a $50,000 credit decision because they came out of the banking business. So they did that. And so it was really around that trying to deal with the fear of using credit card. So they were developing that. And then they decided that they wanted to get, you know, kind of like a credit card. And so we went out and went after it. And
which is really the PayPal model.
The PayPal, except – And I don't know. I'm going to make some supposition about PayPal, but I think PayPal started on eBay to do that same thing, but they didn't have the level of sophistication or knowledge that the people at Bill Me Later did. And so I think it got right down to it. They knew, eBay knew that they needed to have that capability. They could either develop themselves or they could go out and hire the people that already knew that. And so they bought Bill Me Later and put it into PayPal to bring the back end to support the name. So really what you see as PayPal today is really Bill Me Later, brandished around PayPal, but you had the knowledge, capability, and executional skills that the people from Bill Me Later brought in.
And eBay, very, very happy they acquired PayPal.
Oh, yeah.
Very, very happy they acquired Bill Me Later.
Yeah.
They just spun it out. It's funny how the world works, how things get aggregated together and then get spun out. when I looked at the timeline, it looked like there was a very good possibility that you joined the board before anybody even knew eBay could potentially have a remote interest in Bill Me Later.
That's right.
So take us inside. How does a situation like that develop? Were you approached by eBay? Were there investment bankers that went out and said, we think eBay should buy our company? How did that process
play out? Well, so we were in the process of management is really focused on doing an IPO. You know, the seller shares to the public and go become a public company. But the markets got squeegee in those periods of time. And so it's, you start down with a business in you know this, you're in the finance. But so people who start businesses like that have what they want is a liquidity event. And what a liquidity event means is that they somehow monetize all this work. So you can become a public company and sell shares, and then you have, or you can sell to someone like we did in this case. And their focus when I first joined the board was more on an IPO. But the IPO market, as you recall, tech crashed and all that kind of stuff. And so the market itself wasn't great. What happened is that the business was so successful that we were gobbling huge amounts of cash, just gobbling tons of cash. Because you can imagine if you are funding everybody for 30 days, you're funding their purchases. And we were going so fast that we were just getting gobbled. We had gotten to where, we weren't a huge company, and we had gotten to where the banks were saying, hey, we got $1 billion in you guys now, and we just don't know. And so it became an issue we were faced with. How do you continue to feed the beast? And eBay had all the cash in the world, right?
You need they could somebody feed the with beast. A big balance sheet.
Yeah, and yeah. They had the big balance sheet, and so it worked for both businesses.
Okay, excellent. It's fascinating. My classmate from business school is co-founder of eBay, Jeff Skoll.
Oh, okay.
So just... really interesting to watch that whole company develop. And when I saw the Bill Me Later in the eBay, I wanted to kind of get more color on that. Yeah, you mentioned earlier about, growing up in Bountiful. We're going to transition now more into, we just have a couple minutes left, more into kind of the family stuff. How do you balance? So being CEO of a company as big as American Stores, being involved in these various boards. As I mentioned earlier, I'm friends with your son, Jeremy. I've seen you at his house. You guys have a great relationship. I hope when my children are young adults that I have that type of relationship with my kids. And Jeremy shared with me, you were at all the important events in his life, the football games. You were somehow able to get that balance between work and family. Share with us some thoughts. How were you able to do that successfully? Because it's very difficult to do.
Well, I guess first, I married a wonderful woman. and she used to say to me all the time, don't get confused with who you are and what you are. And this is really hard for me. I'm as hard as they come in business and soft as I can be and stuff like this. But Linda always said to me, don't confuse those two things. And, always remember what you are is more important than who you are. And so we always had a balance about that. And I think part of that, I give her a lot of credit. Our kids were in their 30s and we talked about it. I said, geez, I traveled a lot. And the kids said, really? And I said, yeah, I traveled all the time. But, Linda never said to them, geez, Dad's out of town again. And so they didn't focus on that. And so when I was there, they knew I was there, but they didn't know when I was gone. And so I think I give her a lot of credit, but I really do believe that it boils down to what's important to you in life. I mean, it's like they say, whatever's watched grows. And so I think you have to have a good balance in life. It has to be important to you. It always is, to me, always has been. So I just think it's important. I mean, I never thought about anything but my family being most important. I worked to take care of my family. I didn't work for ego or anything like that. I really did work just to take care of my family. That was my goal, and it still is. And I want to try and help Linda, and I want to try and help our grandkids. I remember when Jeremy was, and as you know, Jeremy and I still kiss every time we part, and he's 44, and he was about 9, and I said to Linda, well, when should I quit kissing Jeremy? And she said, when he tells you to. And I never have, and he never has. So, I mean, I just think it's got to be important to you, right? I mean, it's got to be the most important thing in your life, and it's got to be most important every day. And if it's not, then it won't happen. But I mean, when the kids were teenagers, we still to this day take a family vacation every year. We just got back from Disney World and Epcot and Universal, and we took all five grandkids, and we were all there, 11 of us. And we do it once or twice a year, and we love being together. And part of that, I think, being a parent is that you got to remember your kids got a life. And you got to let them do what they want to do. And we never ask to go to their house, Linda and I. We wait to be invited. And that means when we're there, they want us there. So I think as a parent, you got to remember your kids got a life and they want to grow up, and you got to cheer for them and help them be successful. And that's really the secret. It isn't there isn't a formula. It's got to be in your heart and your stomach, and it's got to be what you want out of life. In fact, Linda and I kid all the time when we're around town. Jeremy used to be introduced as our son. We're now introduced as Jeremy's parents, you know. And so he's done well, and it's great. But I think you just have to, your kids have to be important, and you have to spend time with them. And you don't talk to me about quality time. That's great, but you got to have time, and your kids got to know their interest is your interest. And if you know, it's like people, right? I mean, if your kids, it's like the people around you. If you pay attention to them and let them know they're important, you're important back.
Well, you've shared a ton of good advice with us today, perhaps the most valuable of which is the notes you just shared with us. So I know you got emotional over it. I think that's awesome. It shows the level of love and the importance that you place on family. And I see that in your son. And I frankly admire how your son talks about you. And I hope someday my kids talk. I think we all want that. So it's a great note for us to end on. It's an important reminder for everybody. You know, we're all working hard and trying to be successful in the world. And what does that mean to all of us? It's important that, boy, a big component of that, no matter what success means to you, a big component of that is family and relationships. Vic, and so, thanks.
You're welcome. I just say that's all there is, really.
Vic,
thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming in this morning. Our guest this morning has been Victor Lund, former CEO of American Stores Company, as well as former board member of Delta Airlines, Borders Bookstore, and Del Monte's Foods. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW Studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. Thank you, Ross. You do a great job. You can hear our entire interview with Victor on our website, kcpw.org. You can tweet me, @SavvyWells or @KCPW, bottom line. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line. We'll